All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Hong Kong Theatre, welcome to the LSE. My name is Andres Velasco, and I am the Dean of the School of Public Policy. And it is my great pleasure and honor to welcome my dear friend, Professor Luis Garicano, to the school and to this lecture on European Banking Union. I am the number one fan of Mr. Garicano, and I'll tell you why. I'm the lucky guy who is the head of the new School of Public Policy, and when I'm asked by people, what are we hoping to accomplish, I always say, we are hoping to help train future leaders who are both very serious scholars and analytically very capable, and also very bold and very involved, and people who display great leadership qualities and get involved in the, you know, the real affairs of the world. And when I think to myself, well, you know, can someone do both? Can you be a great scholar and a great political leader? And whenever I am getting doubtful, I think, oh, but there is Luis Garicano. He has done it. So if the rest of us have any doubts, we can always point to his example. Luis has had an amazing career. He is an economist by training. Shouldn't blame him for that. He has a PhD from the University of Chicago. He taught for many years at the University of Chicago, and he was also on the faculty at the LSE in the Department of Management. And then one good day, he decided that writing papers was a very noble calling, but changing the world was just as noble, or perhaps nobler. So he joined the world of politics in Spain, was one of the founders of the Ciudadanos Party of Spain. As a footnote, I should add that I helped start the Ciudadanos Party in Chile, so we are believers in the same noble cause. They've done somewhat badly in Chile, we have done very badly, so we have great admiration for them. And of course, today, Luis is a member of the European Parliament and a very influential voice on European and economic affairs in the continent. So, banking union in Europe. I'm not an expert in the subject, but as I understand it, the idea of banking union in Europe has been motivated by two primary goals. One goal was to enlarge the market for banking services and to make it into one big competitive and transparent market. The other was to end what some people call the doom loop or the diabolical loop, which is the rather toxic relationship between the balance sheet of banks and the holding of sovereign bonds, which almost inevitably makes sure that if you have fiscal problems, you also have banking and financial problems, and this is not such a great idea. I am told that Luis is of the view that neither one of these goals has been accomplished thus far, and I think that is a fairly widespread view. But what Luis is going to do tonight is, and I hope I'm not wrong in this description, tell us why those two goals remain to be accomplished and what it is that could be done to make sure that banking union in Europe first gets done fully, and secondly, that it accomplishes these two goals that it hopes to accomplish. So without further ado, Luis, the floor is yours. Luis will speak to us for maybe 40 minutes, and then we will open it up to questions from the audience.
Thanks. Thanks very much. It's really a pleasure to be back at the LSE, and it's wonderful to have so many friendly faces around next to me, and thanks particularly to Andres for the very kind words. I have, as Andres has said, I have possibly kind of left academia, I don't know if I'm sure, but I've been doing politics actively in the European Parliament for 6 months. When I arrived to the European Parliament, the issue I had been working on with somebody like Dimitri Bayanos, who's here in the first row from the finance department, and with some other colleagues around the world, was trying to create a safe asset for Europe. And this proposal was kind of this whole agenda I was told this is crazy to try to work on it because there's no political will. I will tell you, since Dimitri is here, so that you can write it on your reports when you write to the deans. There are no deans here, right? So I can say it. So we proposed, just as anecdotally, we proposed this ESBIS idea in 2011, European Safe Bonds. And this idea actually had the best possible life short of actually being accomplished. Let's say 8 years after we proposed it, well, a few years after we proposed it, the ESRB, the European Systemic Risk Board, ran a whole set of simulations and actually said it was good, which is good that some institution takes it seriously. Then the Commission liked it. The European Commission proposed this in legislation. Instead of calling it ESBIS, as we did, it called it SBBS because they thought ESBIS was a little bit too... It's fine, fine, no problem. And it passed the Commission and it passed the Parliament. It was passed in March 2019. And I hear when it got to Council, which is the government, the member states, it got exactly zero support. It died a very swift death. There was nobody speaking for it. So they told me, don't work on banking union, it's just politically dead. Now, I thought this is a bit crazy because, okay, so why as a politician you need to think of these kind of things? Because if you're going to be working on trying to get an issue forward and there's just no chance that it will work, you can't spend your 5 years in the parliament just pushing a rock like Sisyphus, which basically is gonna fall back every time. That's not gonna be a very intelligent way to dedicate your time. So you really need to try to figure out which things have actually some hope of being accomplished. And I thought, okay, this is a very important topic and it's not really advancing. And then I thought there was a little opportunity. I mean, there's Macron, for once, who wants to do something about all these topics. And then there is the fact that Scholz, the finance minister of Germany, wrote a paper, came out in the FT in November, saying, well, we do think we need a deposit insurance for Europe. We need some common institutions for to assure depositors. I'll tell you all about that in a second, don't worry. And I thought, okay, maybe there is a chance to try to build on this and try to move the ball forward and try to get at least some response to these proposals of Scholz, try to build on them, etc. So I went to all the good thing when you're in politics is that you can actually get to see the people who actually do these things. So I went to the Chancellery in Germany and to the Finance Minister and to the ZE and to all these places. And this is kind of my view of what is politically feasible. Economists will say politically feasible is not enough. It has to be better economically. But I think within the realm of what's politically feasible, this is as good as it gets. Let's see if you guys think this is sufficient. So basically, Andres mentioned the doom loop or the diabolic loop. Dimitri and I and the rest of the co-authors call it a diabolic loop in our initial piece. Basically, it's about contagion. Now, contagion is very fashionable for bad reasons, but contagion then was financial contagion, of course. And the contagion between sovereigns and banks, which has to do with the fact that when sovereigns catch a cold, then banks get the same cold, the same virus, and when banks get the virus, it gets on passed on to sovereigns. Why? From sovereigns to banks, mainly because banks invest very heavily in assets which are basically loans to governments. Okay? These are sovereign bond holdings. From banks to sovereigns, because when a bank is... So if a state has trouble, then immediately that bank that holds all these loans to the state is going to have trouble. From banks to sovereigns, because the rescues when a bank is in trouble are undertaken by sovereigns. Basically, it's like if when an Arkansas or an Arizona bank goes bust, it's the state of Arkansas or the state of Arizona that has to take care of the bank instead of the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. What we have is national resolution, national state aid, national liquidation, national deposit insurance. Now, both of those things are still true. In spite of what we tried with the banking union, there is still high concentration of sovereign debt holdings in the bank balance sheets, and it's still the case that when a bank gets in trouble, it's the state which writes a big check. For example, recently in Germany, the Nobelb, that you probably have followed about heard, in Italy, the Veneto banks, they've been saved by the state. Now, it was supposed to be Europe who was in charge, and it isn't. And I want to explain you why and give you some ideas of a solution. So the solution we put in place for the, and now that Andres has told me that I'm misusing English here, I should say in agony, not agonizing. I'm in agony at my at my title. The banking union is in trouble. We put three pillars in the parlance of Europe. You always talk about pillars to have this banking union. The first pillar is we're going to do supervision together. There's going to be only one supervisor that is going to see if a bank is solvent or not at the European level. That means that you're not going to have the trouble that suddenly some French bank, which has a lot of bad stuff in their balance sheets, bad assets, etc., bad loans, is going to blow up and we didn't know. It's going to be Europe. This single supervisory mechanism exists and it has been huge success. An enormous institutional investment, a very complicated political compromise that was successful. So we have to be happy that this actually happened. The next step was, if the bank is in trouble, we will pick up the pieces as a union. There's a single resolution board. That means we won't let the states worry about that. Europe will worry about that. Now, what is resolution? Resolution basically is a mechanism short of liquidation whereby a bank that is actually wobbly, instead of it's not solvent, and instead of closing it down, having bank runs, etc., you keep it in operations, you pick the assets, you pick the liabilities, you pass them to another bank, and the whole thing keeps going. This, I say here, is like having a luxury car in the garage. We do have the resolution mechanism. It has a lot of professional people. It's actually well-staffed. There's a German head, Ökekörning. But basically, every time there is a banking mess in Europe, this organism says, not my problem. They have a decision to make, which is made the public interest assessment or public interest test, in which this mechanism has to decide, is it really in the public interest that we take care of this failure, or it's a national problem. You would think, okay, if the bank is $200 or $300 million, then in assets, then it's national. But they've decided that banks which are up to 60 billion in assets, such as the Veneto banks, are not in the public interest. Essentially, as I will show you, they've passed on everything. I will discuss why. Third, we said we're going to put deposit insurance at the European level. If depositors are in trouble, it won't be the state of France or Spain who will take care of that trouble. It will be the whole union, the union as a whole. Now, this hasn't even been started. There is no deposit insurance. Right now, deposit insurance is national. Together with these three pillars, there will be a set of rules that will be common, a deposit guarantee scheme directive, bank resolution framework, etc. Just, I don't need to explain you anything about those except to tell you that when people put this framework in place, they thought European resolution was for the many and not for the few. They thought most banks would be resolved by Europe, and it would be the exception if the national authorities would intervene. The fact is, it's been the opposite. There have been rules that the key mechanism that was put in place and that has been the reason for all this political trouble is the bail-in. The bail-in says the investors in the bank itself are the ones who pick up the pieces and who lose money if the bank is insolvent. Traditionally, what we've done is bailouts. The bankers go, this is terrible, this is systemic, you need to help us out, and the state duly writes a big check. The truth of the matter is the symbiosis between banks and sovereigns, it's formal, as I showed you before, but it's also informal. There is, you know, when there's a banking crisis, you generally have, when there's a sovereign debt crisis, you generally have the chancellor or the treasury finance minister. Who do they call? The head of a big bank. In Germany, the head of the Deutsche Bank for advice. Who do they call here? HSBC. What's going on in the markets? What happens? What do these guys think? Well, everything has to be paid. Nobody can lose any money. Banks need to be rescued. Vice versa. When the banks are in trouble, the state, which has counted on their advice, is going to have, when the state doesn't have money, it's borrowing it from the banks and it's actually forcing the banks to lend it. When the banks are in trouble, it's going to be asking advice for the banks, who are going to say, yes, yes, you need to bail us out. There's this incestuous relationship between banks and states, whereby basically the taxpayer always picks up the tab. Banks basically, generally, there's a truth to that, they are the basic plumbing on a fair economic system, but they are not necessarily enthusiastic about having to borrow at market rates and find it preferable to have the guarantee of the state behind that no bank ever falls. So the rules on bail-ins are circumvented and the state comes generally with a check. I've made a couple of claims that need backing up. I'll show you a little bit of evidence to back it up. First, I told you, and Andres said, banking union is failing. There is not a single market for banking. This is how fragmented the banking market is in Europe. In the left graph, you have cross-border and domestic lending. What you see is that cross-border lending is 35% lower than it was when the crisis started. So basically making a loan by a French institution to a German one or a Spanish one to an Italian one. When you look at loans and deposits, which is the blue bars, the loans and deposits which are cross-border, they are, so an Italian bank that has deposits from France or that makes loans in France, you see that they have gone down from $8 trillion to $5 trillion since the crisis. So banks are becoming more and more national. Why? Because if the rescue is going to be national, the states are going to say, oh, I'm going to be responsible for writing the checks, right? So I need to make sure that the bank has enough money in my state. So Belgium, for example, which has several French banks operating in Belgium, says, no, these French banks operating in Belgium have to, quote, ring fence quite a bit of loans and deposits in Belgium, quite a bit of liquidity and capital in Belgium in case something goes wrong. But then think about it. You're a French bank, you have at home liquidity and capital for the entire group, and in each one of the countries, liquidity and capital for that particular part of the group, which means it doesn't make sense to be cross-border. What's the advantage? I'm going to, instead of diversifying, I'm going to have extra layers of capital that are going to cost me extra. So the banks are withdrawing their international operations and they are much more being national. I also made a second claim, which was that we still have the channel of contagion from sovereigns to banks. This is the amount of sovereign bonds that are from the country itself as proportion of the whole sovereign portfolio of the bank. If you were in a single market, the French bank could have bonds from Italy, from Germany, from Spain, from whatever, and so a Dutch bank, etc. What you see is that the Cyprus bank only has Cyprus bonds, the Greek bank has 85% of Greek bonds, the Italian bank has 80% of Italian bonds, and if you look at it, to be honest, it doesn't look like this is going down. It should be diversifying as banking union progresses. It isn't. This is another way to cut it, not on sovereign exposure as a proportion of your whole bond exposure, but as a proportion of tier one capital. And what you see is that basically it's more than the entire tier one capital is accounted by your exposure, and it's again not systematically decreasing. I made a third claim, which was about the rescues and the bail-ins. Let me just wait until I talk about that in the second part of this proposal. So I told you, like, basically, what's the starting point? The starting point is we have a fragmented banking market in which banks keep kind of investing in their own bonds, and in which I told you the rescues keep being national. That part I haven't documented, but you will see it in a second. What I'm going to do is I'm going to suggest one proposal to cut this part of the loop that has quite a bit to do with the proposal that I told you Dimitri Bayans and me and others worked on. And one proposal to work on this part of the loop, and they're going to both be simple and hopefully pretty clear to understand. The first part is, okay, we want sovereigns to be cut off from banks so that if a sovereign is in trouble, if Italy is in trouble or Greece is in trouble, you won't have all the Italian banks collapsing and a whole contagion and a whole banking crisis, okay? Which is what happened before. Remember, the financial crisis in Europe has two types of countries. There are countries which were very insolvent as countries, and the banks came next. That would be the case of Greece or Portugal or even Italy, although it didn't get to this point. There were some countries where the banks were the trouble, and then the states came next, Spain and Ireland. There was a big housing bubble, banks had a lot of trouble, banks collapsed, the state is like, oh my goodness, how do we rescue this system? So the contagion from sovereign to banks is the first thing we need to cut. And in order to do this, you need to have banks diversify. You need to ask banks, hey guys, you can't just invest in one asset of one state, you need to invest in, you have to have a diversified portfolio. The traditional way this has been accomplished through the last 6, 7, 8 years, tried to accomplish with complete failure, is by saying, okay, there is an exception in the Basel rules. Basel rules say banks have to put capital whenever they take risks. You cannot just make a loan and assume the loan will be repaid. If you make a loan to a developer, you have to be cautious about the possibility the developer doesn't pay you back. There's one exception to that. Sovereigns. You can lend as much as you want to a sovereign, you don't have, it's a zero risk weight. You can assume that it's risk-free. One solution is to say, hey, we're going to apply risk weights to the sovereigns. Super easy. Now, this solution has been impossible to accomplish, as I was telling you.
For sovereigns only within Europe.
Within Europe, correct. So, Chilean banks can invest in Chilean debt, American banks in American debt, and euro area sovereigns on euro area debt for free. Now, they don't necessarily need to invest in the French debt if you're French. That's what is puzzling here. Now, the problem with trying to apply the risk weights has several aspects that I want to discuss. The first, some are economic and some are political. The economic, I would say, is we've seen that these ratings are not great. Okay, we've seen during the crisis, first of all, they're extremely pro-cyclical. Next time you see somebody from Moody's, you ask them, okay, England has sovereign debt position, growth position, demographics, productivity, all those things are given. If all those things don't change and England has an accident, they can't access the markets, will it change the ratings? And they will say yes. They will change the ratings if all the fundamentals are right, just because the market panics. But the whole point of the ratings is to be a signal which is independent of what the market says. So the ratings are not great. That's an economic issue. It's pro-cyclical, and it is noisy and effective. But most importantly, there's a political obstacle. You would have been saying to countries like Italy, Greece, or Portugal, and even Spain, I think, that the debt is second rate. You would be telling them, well, you know, your banks cannot buy this debt. That means you are making it more expensive for them to finance the debt. You're talking about Italy, which has, for example, 130% of debt to GDP. I mean, if this grows up by 1 point because the financing cost of the Italian debt, you're really creating like very serious problem for the Italian budget. I mean, imagine you would be having to cut 1.5% of your deficit immediately for that. So this is really politically a non-starter. And basically, if you talk to the Italian chancellors or to the Italian treasury or to any of these treasuries, they'll tell you, oh, they are dead bodies. There are going to be differences in risk weights for different countries. This is an exemption from Basel. It applies to all of us. So some people are saying, like Nicolas Véran, some people are saying, oh, the way out of this is to put limits on concentration. We allow people to have the sovereign debt, but we don't allow them to have more than a certain proportion of their capital or whatever other requirement you want. The problem with this is those countries still don't like it. Because if you say, okay, if you have 33 to 50% of exposure, you have to apply a risk weight of 15, those countries are going to say, okay, so the banks that are overexposed dump this debt, who's going to buy it? So they don't like this. Scholz kind of played on this in his letter, and he says, well, we put a concentration factor and a risk weight, so there is a risk weight that depends on how concentrated you are and how risky it is, but again, politically non-starter. So Dimitri, me, and all these other guys, we said, okay, it's obvious what you need here. You need a safe asset for Europe that all banks hold in their portfolios, and that safe asset, I will explain you in a minute how it works, would allow banks to diversify without anybody kind of having to suffer the indignity of not being able to finance their debts. And it will be safe, as you will see in a second. That's not been possible, as I told you at the start, and I go back to the politics in a minute. So here's the proposal. Here is the capital key, the first proposal I'll tell you about. This is the capital key of the European Central Bank. This is an objective, simple measure everybody understands, and it corresponds roughly to the economic weights of the countries. What we're going to tell the banks is, if you have this portfolio, you have a portfolio which has 26% German and 20% France and 17% Italy, we are going to call you diversified. You will understand in a second why. So here is how it works for those more a little bit more mathematically inclined, to show that I've not become gone completely native. So you measure the exposure of a particular bank, you measure the capital key, you calculate the distance. So this is BNP Paribas. BNP Paribas has 10%, 10.9% of German debt, 31% of French debt, 21% of Italian, 9% of Spanish. You calculate the vector of differences. You calculate the distance, just the simplest distance metric. I'm happy to put another one. And you say, this is how far you are from diversified. We're calling this key diversified. We're calling these where you have more weight on a country than what it's economically the weight of that country as undiversified. So then you say, we're not going to have risk weights, we're going to have concentration weights. And those concentration weights are going to depend on how far you are from diversified. There's a distance metric that tells you the further you are, the more your capital charges. Now, economically, why does this make sense? It makes sense because we're diversifying the system. The aggregate risk is going down because nobody's now concerned that if one bank collapses, one sovereign collapses, the whole banking system of that country goes down. And politically, it makes sense because when I go to the Treasury in Italy, I tell them, look, your banks are going to have to be dumping Italian debt, no question, but the German banks or some other banks are going to be diversified into this other debt. So politically, it makes sense. Now, the problem is, of course, with the word safe. Is this safe? If Greece goes down, then all banks in the European Union have some Greek debt, and that's a problem. And that's where I think the whole path comes in. The way I would think about this proposal, if it were to be taken into practice, would be, first we define the safe portfolio approach, then we raise this curve and make it more steep so that banks are diversifying more. The incremental capital charges with distance are bigger, so we push the banks to diversify. Then we facilitate securitizations that have these right concentrations. And then, and here is the old SBBS or the old SBS back through the back door, we tranche it. Basically, we're going to say, look, we don't want the capital in the banks to be risky. So we don't want the investments of the banks in sovereigns to be risky. And what we're going to do is we have a senior debt and a junior debt. Here is how it works. You have this diversified portfolio of bonds, which you're pulling. You create a senior bond and you create a junior bond. The junior bond absorbs the risk of a particular country going bust. If Greece goes bust, and Greece, remember, is 2.5% of this portfolio, then you could have banks lose, Greece loses 20% of its value, banks lose 0.5 of that investment, of this 2.5% to 2. But alternatively, you say this: only the holders of the junior tranche of the security face this problem. The senior bonds are safe. What's the advantage of this? The advantage is all banks have a safe asset. Europe creates a safe asset, which is the senior tranche. Any flight to safety, when people panic, they all head towards the safe asset, and the safe asset is common. Now, let me tell you the two difficulties of this proposal. The two difficulties of this proposal are the northern countries hear safe asset, and they say, ooh, crazy, too risky, scary. But the southern countries, which are desperate to have a real safe asset, say, and if you ask Olivier Blanchard, or if you ask an economist, you probably ask Andrés Velasco, who is out of this political mess, and they say, look, you have a monetary union. Forget about securitization. You need a real safe asset. A common safe asset with a treasury minister, with finance, with taxes that flow into the exchequer. That's what is needed. Sadly, I have to tell you, the prospects of that are exactly nil, zero. Okay, that's not going to happen. Only if Europe has like the biggest financial storm again and the whole euro is going to collapse in 6 months because of who knows what, then some radical proposal like Hamilton, you know, making the US into a single federal entity, transferring all the tax powers, monopoly on taxes and foreign policy to the US government. It would require something like that. War or, you know, I don't know, something big. So short of that, we have a path towards a safe asset in which we can stop. Martin Sandbull wrote a long piece in the FT about this proposal, and he said, you can stop at 3. He said, look, you don't need, he said, Gargano is arguing that at the end you need tranching. Tranching is going to be too complicated. People are going to be confused. You don't need that. Just make banks diversify, but this portfolio, then we've gotten rid of the excessive sovereign risk. We've done. That's possible. I think at the end of the day, you do need to go to a completely safe asset, which tranching does give you. Now, I promise you a second proposal, and I promise you also to not be long. So I will just be relatively quick so that we can have a dialogue, and then you also can ask. The second proposal is basically, I want to call it SRB plus, needs to try to break this loop between banks and sovereigns. And again, the name of the game is more politics than economics. This is more political economy than economic policy. Okay? So I'm not going to tell you this is the best economic proposal ever, although I think this is quite solid, but I want to tell you this has some possibility and some hope of actually landing. So right now, we have national resolutions with state aid injections, with national liquidations, and with a deposit insurance, which is national. How do we solve that? So we're going to try to make an FDIC in Europe. And we have to build an FDIC from what we have, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. That's what they have in the US, to cut the contagion between banks and sovereigns. In the same way that when a bank in Arkansas is not rescued by Arkansas State, so that when a bank in Greece is not rescued by Greece and makes Greece go bankrupt. Okay, I promised you evidence of its bailout and not bail-in. Look at this table. Here we have almost all of the troubled banks of a certain size in Europe that have failed since this mechanism of resolution was put in place. What you see by our own calculations is that if the calculation is wrong, I will blame Pablo, who is just sitting here in front. If it's right, I will have said in plural. So 34 billion euro bailout versus 7.4 billion bail-in. When people set up this system, what it was supposed to happen is that investors lose the money. I mean, this is capitalism, okay? If you invest and this thing doesn't go well, you lose the money you invested. It's not a big deal. Now, supposedly banks are these sacred entities that can't ever, nobody who puts money in the bank can lose money. It's not about depositors losing money, mind you. Depositors, we all agree, have to be safe. It's about subordinated debt holders and other holders of instruments which are explicitly told, if you buy this instrument, you might lose money. Now, what happens? For example, let me tell you the Veneto banks. These are banks with 60 billion in euros in total. There was a recapitalization that cost the Italian taxpayer 16.8 billion. Why? First, politics. So let me tell you the process. The process is the SSM, the European Central Bank, says this bank is terrible, it's failing or likely to fail. Then the SRB looks at it and says, oh, is this a public interest? Do we have to do it or do we leave the Italian state to do it? The SRB says, what a mess. Okay? This is real big trouble. And if it can find a reason that it's not really necessary to risk it, passes it to the Italians. Now, here's what happens. The Italians think, oh, yeah, we want to do a bail-in. Maybe they have some initial willingness to do a bail-in. But they realized in this particular case that these bail-inable securities, the people who were going to lose their shirts on their investments, were not American hedge funds. They were Veneto grandmothers and dentists who had been sold through the branch networks these subordinated securities. The problem with that is politically it's catastrophic, right? Imagine the Italian minister who says all these grandmothers and widows and dentists are going to lose because these banks went wrong. So the Italian government decided to give them not just a golden funeral, but a golden and diamond-studded funeral where everybody who had ever put the money went whole. You can imagine, I don't know anything about this, the arbitrage opportunities here. You can imagine the amount of people who've gotten rich by guessing that the system in Europe was not going to work. Okay, you go, you buy subordinated debt of a bank that is just about to fail at 5 or 10 cents to the dollar. You wait for the bail-in, which never happens, and you multiply your investment by 10. Okay, 16.8 billion means 12 billion asset guarantees, 4.8 billion in injections. Now, the Germans were very holy about this. Sorry, Walsrod, you know they are. The Germans were very holy about this, complain, and then do exactly the same thing. Nord LB is restructured, quote, on market terms. You should see the term sheet for the restructuring. There is no market terms, okay? This is like, we assume that the bank is going to grow in profits by like 500%, revenue doubles in the next 3 years, and they will fire half of their people next year. I mean, seriously, I mean, it's state aid. It's just a state aid that is kind of dressed in this beautiful way by the state. So, what we have is not a system that aligns investors' incentives and the bank's incentives by ensuring that there is a bail-in. It's not a system that makes capitalism work in other words, and it's not a system that protects the taxpayers from the contagion, but just the old system in which, you know, who's left holding the bag, you know? So what can we do? I will go through a couple of quick ideas. First, what happens is a bank like Nord LB spent 18 months in intensive care. They don't have enough capital, nobody wants to rescue them, and they're just bleeding money. In the US, they would have been given 3 months. If in 3 months they don't get capital, they have to go to, it is called prompt corrective action, they get 3 more months to sell out. So you need to limit the amount of time that they can be on intensive care, and you need to force the regulator, the European regulator, to intervene in the banks. That's one, so not have a judgment call, but have an objective decision that they always have to take. But the most important thing is you want to create, and this is where I'm going to finish the proposal, not to bore you with details. You want to create a European Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The FDIC has resolved 1,000 banks in the US in the last 8 years, now it's 10 years. Basically, goes into a bank, takes the assets, takes the liabilities, passes it to somebody else, closes, left where it's there for liquidation, and nobody loses any money, no taxpayers lose any money, sorry, and the whole thing is kind of painless. What you need is to have the SRB have more power, you need to add European deposit insurance and put it under the same roof. In the US, there are no two funds. There's not a fund for resolving banks and deposit insurance. There's just one fund, which is deposit insurance. Well, put this deposit insurance together. Now, clever people will say, oh, you told us that deposit insurance was politically very hard. The reason it's politically very hard is moral hazard. The Germans are terrified, Northern Europeans are terrified of moral hazard. They say, look, if I insure your deposits, what is going to prevent the Greek government, for example, or the Spanish government, from saying, all mortgages, let me take it to the extreme. No, this is not in the cards, but from saying, all mortgages are pardoned. Imagine you, the Spanish government, say, all mortgages are pardoned. Then, or anybody who can pay the mortgage can stay in their house, which is more likely. Or banks go bust. Spain says, no problem, there's a European deposit insurance, Germans hold the bank. That's what they are afraid of, okay? That's the moral hazard they're afraid of. That if we cover the deposits, then what incentive do countries have not to change the terms of loans and favor the debtors? What we added in this proposal are two ideas that are trying to deal, at least to some extent, with moral hazard. First, there is a national deposit insurance compartment, this DGS, which has different sizes depending on the country risk. So countries, only when the money in the national compartment is finished, does the European deposit insurance come in. Second, the contributions by the banks are going to be depending on the risks of particular banks, meaning there is not, like now, a contribution to the deposit insurance that is just basically every bank pays the same. And that's going to reduce the risk taken by banks. So basically, what the proposal tries to do is tries to say, let's do a system that is not very satisfactory at the start because it doesn't really give you a lot of risk sharing, but it advances towards solving these problems that I've told you about, which are that in Europe, national banks are, normally it was said, European banks are European in life, but national in death. European banks are right now national in life and in death, and you need to have a system that basically allows for a European institution to take care of all the banks. I hope I didn't make it too technical. I mean, if anybody wants to go into any of the details, happy to do it. Basically, what I've been proposing is some politically feasible, but economically not quite all the way for what we would want, solutions to cut the doom loops that basically both the contagion here and here still exist. Basically, for sovereign to banks, start by forcing banks to have a diversified sovereign debt holdings and may move later to a common asset. For banks to sovereigns, basically creating SRB Plus, which is basically a European Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation with a national compartment and with some elements that protect northern deposit insurance from this risk. To be honest, when I say northern, I make commas, because the truth of the matter is the most risky banking system in Europe right now is the German banking system. It has 1,700 small banks in which they are entangled, the politicians and the banks. Basically, politicians are occupying seats in all these banks. And they have a deposit insurance scheme, the Sparkassen, which is like basically they promise, but not in a very credible contractual way, to take care of each other's loans and debts. So to be honest, I mean, if there was a banking crisis in Europe, it's more likely to come from Germany than anywhere else. Of course, if it came from Germany, probably Germany would write the big checks. So that's where we are. We are at the place where basically each country is on its own. Thank you very much. I hope I was not too clear.
Thank you very much, Luis. When I was in graduate school, I had, as a professor at Yale, an economic historian who used to say that in the history of Latin America, the threat of bankruptcy when deployed against banks had no credibility. I am learning that in Europe, the threat of bankruptcy against banks has no credibility. So, you know.
Sounds familiar.
It sounds familiar, exactly. The world is more similar than we like to think. Okay, much food for thought here. These are challenging proposals. I think they're a very nice mixture of technical ingenuity and, we hope, political feasibility. So the floor is open. Yes, sir, back there. Yes, I know, yeah. I'll get to you in a second.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm a graduate student at the School of Public Policy. So I have two questions. One is, should Nordel Bay be considered a bailout in spite of the Lower Saxony government being in the being a shareholder from before the crisis occurred? And secondly, in terms of political economy, as you mentioned, is your proposal Pareto efficient, do you think? And what do northern countries gain from exposing their banks to risky southern public bonds compared to a situation in which they're holding safe northern public bonds? Thank you.
Okay, two excellent questions. So one of the problems with the NordLB rescue is that it's a public bank owned by public entities. And so these public entities say, oh yeah, this is the shareholders are putting money behind the bank. What else do you want? The problem is that there are rules to make market work. And the idea is that for the public money to be considered an investment, not a bailout, it has to be made at the same conditions and same market conditions that it would be, this contribution would be made by a private investor. And that's where the kind of assumptions in the business plan that I was mentioning before come in. The kind of conditions, the price at which they enter, the assumptions that were in the business plan, etc., where, I mean, I don't think anybody in Europe has considered those credible. It's not credible, and it's not reassuring, because it means that basically every single time that this has been tried, it has failed. That's the problem, except for Banco Popular in Spain. On your second, what a need for Northern, for Germany. So Germany, I mean, the interesting thing about the situation right now is that many German politicians say, we don't want to entangle ourselves in rescuing anybody. But the current situation has an implicit rescue promise, meaning if you're promising that states cannot go down, if the states are linked to the banks, if something happens, somebody's going to have to pay up. If you basically can persuade them and can make it credible that the system is safer as a whole, that their possibility of any bailout is going to be lower, then you're actually saving the money. I agree with you that this really relies on, hey, the current situation has guarantees all over the place. Right. And that's a case that they might not be willing to make. Some politicians in Germany might say, no, we're not going to rescue anybody. I mean, the last time they tried that, they ended up. And to be honest, as you know, when they ended up rescuing lots of banks, it wasn't just rescuing the foreign governments, but we're rescuing their own investors, who are the ones who are investing in those banks.
Dimitri, I had a question, but I just kind of follow up very briefly on this. I'm trying to understand the reasoning behind the German position, because as you pointed out, the idea that by promising not to bail in, you get good behavior has been proven to be false. So you're not comparing a first best to some moral hazard potentially arising, you're comparing a situation in which moral hazard could arise against a situation in which moral hazard has arisen, right?
Totally.
It's there already. So given that, the counterfactual is a situation in which you have deposit insurance, you have more vigorous regulation, and plausibly, as you were just hinting, the risk for the German taxpayer is smaller, not bigger. Is this a case that politically can be made in Europe, or is it something that we economists understand but the politicians wouldn't follow?
I've been in the Chancellery, and I've been in the Bundestag, and I've been in the Ministry of Finance, and I've talked to people and different people who obviously can't, not have freedom to mention and so on. But my sense is that this kind of case could be made. The problem, I would think, is that there are a lot of new parties and new populists in Germany mm-hmm. who would probably seize on an argument like the one you're making to say the whole thing is rotten, let's get out of this. I mean, I would think that, and we have experts in German politics here, so I'd be happy to hear the comment. But you don't understand the German side?
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, well, that's not one thing that I can claim to understand. Dimitri. A microphone?
Yes, just bring the microphone, please. Yes.
Can you, so I understand kind of the logic of the proposals is to kind of do things that are economically sensible, but also try to kind of make them more politically feasible than, so can you elaborate a bit on that aspect on the safe asset proposal? So you kind of, you say you want to make it appealing to the Italians because you will tell them that, okay, we're going to, through this distance metric, your Italian banks are going to hold less Italian debt, but German banks are going to hold more German debt. Sorry, more Italian debt. How do you make it appealing to the Germans? I mean, wouldn't the Germans complain that you say, you know, our banks are fine, they're holding German debt. Now you're forcing them to hold Italian debt as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the main issue. And I think the answer has to do with systemic risk. I think you have to tell them, look, this is the most politically feasible or the only politically feasible way to reduce sovereign exposure by banks and to reduce concentration. You can also put large concentration limits, but you are going to cut off the loop or reduce the contagion, and as a result, it's less likely that you will have to come and rescue any entire financial system, that you will have a systemic risk in Italy or in Greece or in Spain or in France. And that's why, I mean, Andreas is saying, look, but then you have, you know, can you make the claim that there has been an implicit guarantee to rescue these countries, and then you can make a claim that this is better. And the question is whether you can make it explicit, that the truth of the matter is, in the current situation, the German taxpayer is probably on the hook for, I mean, if Italy is in trouble, who's going to pay for that?
Mm-hmm. Eric?
So Eric Berghoff here at LSE. So, you know, in the midst of the crisis, we tried to make this distinction between so the legacy part of the issue and the sort of forward-looking part of the issue. And obviously, we're still kind of suffering from legacy issues, but it seems like the problem is actually, even if you just focus on the forward-looking part, you may still not get there. I mean, some of these issues are about the legacy of Italian debt and legacy of German banks. You know, so that's one part of my question. The second part of my question is, imagine a country that is now outside the banking union, and say Sweden, which is, you know, contemplating joining. How does it look, you know, this problem for that country, and do we need a solution to this before we can expect others to join?
So, Eric also and I were working. Eric was spearheading a big effort to get a lot of economists to give a response in 2011, 2012. So we've also been working on this long ago, on trying on the crisis, basically on what the crisis was going on at the time. So, I would say, is this being recorded or not? I would say...
This is what happens when you become a politician, you see?
I would say, I mean, Europe needs to put itself in order. I mean, I think that's as hard as that. I mean, I think that if you are going to join the euro and there is no guarantee that there is a problem for the there is not a solution to these contagion risks, then
you probably need to think twice about it. Oh, and legacy debt. I'm so sorry. So do we want to treat differently legacy debt? So ideas that have been on the table, just to tell you what Eric is pointing out. You could say, for example, right now the European Central Bank has a massive amount of debt from all the countries that it's been buying. So just the easiest way to deal with legacy debt would be for the European Central Bank to condone all this debt. It would just say, okay, you don't need to repay it, or we make it perpetuities or whatever. Then everybody starts from zero. This is politically problematic, as you can imagine. The only risk-sharing mechanism we really have in Europe is the European Central Bank, and its risk-sharing ability depends on not abusing these kind of powers. But you could do it through a fiscal authority. You could say, we're going to buy all these European debt, from legacy debt, and put it in a type of bond, and then start from scratch with a new set of debt. There was a red bond, blue bond proposal that would try to do this. And the Commission is talking about something called e-bonds, which is kind of similar. So, which differentiates the two tiers of debt. I would say it makes even harder the concerns of the highly indebted country of accessing markets. If you, on the margin, you have new debt that has no guarantee. So if you kind of separate legacy from, if you condone it, not. But if you make it separate in a way you're saying this part is protected, this part is not, I would say it has economically makes quite a bit of sense, but politically I would see it as non-starter as well.
So Angelo Martelli, European Institute. So back to the political will. And Nordel B case, and I know I'm going to be a bit controversial and a bit hard for you to answer this, because your colleague, Margaret, actually in the DG competition approved the deal. So DG competition cleared on market terms the deal. And also then the chief economist at the time, the Italian, then said actually was not really done on market terms. So if the political will does not come from the member states, maybe it can come from DG competition. That's the first point. The second one, so was Scholz's proposal and the FT article just a bluff in terms of, then are we back to actually the Brunner Meyer, Landau, Harold James story of it's really liquidity versus solvency story, and we are back to that loop?
I would say on the first, I would not criticize Marie Tresire. I think she's done a great job at competition. She's done a great job at trying to keep the rules the same for everybody. But the truth is that I think DGCOM bought in a very optimistic story of the German government about this. So I was not impressed with this particular decision. On the second issue, I don't think Scholz was bluffing. Dimitri, do you remember? Did you met your cookies? Your cookies, yes. So your cookies was a financial economist. He was a PhD student in Chicago when I was there as well. And he's the Secretary of State of Finance in Germany. He's, and Scholz, an entire team, is quite serious about solving the shortcomings of this problem. There's Jacob Weizsäcker as well. Jacob Weizsäcker is also a good economist, co-author of Sedemeyer and so on. And he's been an MEP, so he did a bit what I'm doing. He was an economist, he went to the parliament, and now he's back in the finance ministry. And I think they are very conscious of the political constraints, but when they made that proposal, they really thought they were restarting banking union. The answer by Roberto Gualtieri, the finance minister of Italy, was like, well, this is non-starter. We don't even want to think about this. But I thought they were actually trying to at least show some cooperativeness and some willingness to move things forward.
Luis, of course, I only want to divert you from Germany bashing with my questions. Mm-hmm. The first is, Can you explain to me again why your safe portfolio approach is politically more promising than this concentration surcharge that Nicolas Véran and others have proposed? And the second is your single resolution board plus really different from your safe portfolio approach? Because what I think, what really makes the FDIC so successful, as you say, is that it is basically invested in US treasuries and therefore has also, if something goes wrong and it is overstretched, it has access to, can lend it, you know, to get its treasuries as collateral and get liquidity from the Federal Reserve. If that is true, then giving a banking license to the ESM would actually be the closest to reproduce that for the emergencies that may come.
Okay, so the first was about the political feasibility of the safe portfolio or the economic?
Why is that politically more promising your proposal
than the sovereign surcharge? So basically, the limits, the proposals that Nicolas Véran has. So I think the proposal that has a portfolio has two advantages. Economically, it's a first stage towards a diversified safe asset. It's the first stage. So if you have a portfolio that banks have to trade, then very naturally the market is going to produce an asset, and then very naturally you can offer tranches on the security. Politically, what that you can do with the own thing because you just have this limit of 30%. Politically, I think that Nicolas Véran, the idea of limiting the amount that you have of a particular sovereign by a certain amount does force you in a way that is economically good to damp some sovereign risk, but it doesn't provide any demand for it. And that's kind of the thing that makes it. If there was a common asset, everybody would be happy to dump risk because they would all borrow together as Europeans. The thing is, can you reproduce a situation where people somehow have access as Europeans to market? I mean, it's a very pale comparison, okay? And by making what is safe something that requires you to invest in all the sovereigns, you're making all the sovereigns interested in this borrowing in a way that they're not here, because all that happens is Italian debt is done by the market, by the banks, and who is buying? As to, is it crucial that the FDIC has access to bonds which are issued by the Treasury? I don't think so. I think that the SRB plus, I mean, I do definitely think that you need to give some access to liquidity, and you need a lender of last resort role to make this work for the SRB. But this SRB has access to the entire set of European deposit insurance, not just the deposit insurance that is on the European level, but also the national insurance that is on the national level, because it coordinates all that. So in terms of access to funds, I mean, this European deposit insurance should never be short in any way. I mean, I wouldn't expect that to be a constraint. In terms of access, I mean, I would think they do need to have access to some lender plus resort, but they don't need that to be against treasury collateral. I mean, they could be against a portfolio of European bonds.
Roska. Microphone is coming.
Sorry. Biroška also from LSE. Excellent, thank you so very much. A lot of doubts based on one's experience, of course, but it's refreshing to see sort of the political element to be involved in this. So question number one, the Véran proposal is a regulatory measure.
The which proposal?
It's the Véran proposal. It's yes. A regulatory.
Agreed.
Now, on your proposal would have some regulatory element. Would you require a pass to be taken by banks or not? So
yes.
Do you see? So that's number one. Question number two is a little bit crazy, but I'm wondering whether new stuff cannot be brought into the discussion. That is central bank digital currency. If you have central bank digital currency, that alleviates the need to the extent that you, but there are a lot of it, but to the extent, assume you introduce that, and you introduce it maybe at the ECB level, to the extent you have that, you eliminate the need for deposit insurance. So you eliminate that.
You eliminate the need for banks, to be honest.
Pardon?
You eliminate the existence of banks.
No, you can limit this. I mean, you have deposit insurance of 100,000 euros today. You can limit the central bank digital currency to that limit. So I'm not buying that, weigh them up a little bit in terms of competition and service and everything. So if you think that's a non-starter, then you don't have to answer my question number two, just number one. But I think central bank should really think about this trade-off.
I think we need to think about it. I'm not persuaded, but I think we need to think about it. So on question number one, yes, I would help this diversification along in two ways regulatorily. So exactly in the same way as Varon would change regulation, I would change regulation here. Basically, as you increase distance, you're going to have capital charges which are increasing. Second, I would suggest that we would change regulation so that sovereign securitization with the right concentrations would count zero risk weight, but not the other sovereign securitization, so that as to lead people to diversify in the right way. Jean-Pierre.
JP Zegrand from the FMG. I would like to look at it from another point of view. One problem of banking union not being in place is that monetary policy is messed up. The transmission doesn't work, rates are too low, banks suffer as a result. There is all of these monetary issues behind it. Is there a way to attack this problem from the monetary side of things? I have no idea what the ECB can or cannot do. But could the ECB ask for something like you suggested? So this is neither regulatory nor political, but the ECB can say something like, all right, you Italian bank, you want to come to the repo window. We take some of your stuff, but it can only be a third Italian bonds and 10% German bonds, or something like this, forcing the banks, because the banks would be happy to hold other stuff if that helps the interest rate policy and they become more profitable as a result. It's a hold-up problem we're looking at. Is there a way that you work with the ECB somehow on implementing it from that other angle? I'm just making this up.
Yes, no, I think this is very, very good suggestion. I mean, the paper was actually written to present at the ECB, and I presented it on the 19th of December there, and I talked to everybody there, I think, or to a lot of people there. I think the reason the ECB liked our SBBS, our SBIS proposal, was partly because of something related to what you're saying. I think they've always seen, if they're going to start unwinding quantitative easing, which doesn't seem to be about to happen in our generation or the next generation, or I don't know. It's not something very likely now, given the decisions taken this year. If they were to start unwinding quantitative easing, I would say they would want to be able to, instead of destabilize debt markets by dumping something and the other who's going to buy it, they would prefer to do packages. And the way that I think some of us saw the SBBS starting would be as a securitized, as a security that actually the ECB would put on the market, try it out, start with small quantities, see if it gets bought and sell, and do it more. The ECB has always been, with the exception of Vittorio Constancio, but most of the board, the chief economist, Philip Lane, is the co-author of Dimitri and me on this proposal. So, I mean, the recent chief economist. So the general mood of the ECB has been very, very positive to this idea of diversifying the bank's portfolios. And I wouldn't be surprised if actually, at least on the unwinding of the QE, but I wouldn't think on the repo window, because that seems like dynamite, right? I mean, that's where, I mean, the liquidity, if you hold up the liquidity, then you're, in some sense, you're using a nuclear bomb to solve the problem, right? It seems a bit destabilizing. But I would think that the ECB has a lot of things it could do, and I think you're very right.
Yes. Hi, I'm Jeevan, a graduate student in the IR department.
In the?
International Relations.
All right.
So given that the lack of banking union within the euro area has been touted as a reason for the prevention of the euro becoming an international currency, assuming that there's the political desire, in your view, do any of your two approaches, do you think they will help the euro become an international currency?
That's a great question. Okay, so here is something that nobody had realized until June this year. Maybe many people have realized. Some people hadn't realized in June this year. The European Union, because it doesn't even have a payment system denominated in euros, can't actually have an independent enforcement on the sanctions on Iran. So when the US said, not trade with Iran, and Europe said, well, sorry, we're continuing, there was actually literally no way to get those payments going without going through the US payment mechanism. So suddenly, everyone in Europe is extremely worried about exactly what you said, the international role of the euro. Suddenly, everybody thinks something that was like, oh yeah, well, the role of the euro is an interesting thing. Now they're like, yeah, we need an international role. We need a euro that is actually protecting our sovereignty, to put it in Macron's words. Would these proposals do that? Yes, I would think so. I mean, I would think if you have the confidence that these kind of loops, this kind of contagion is less likely to happen, the euro will be much more stable and much more likely to be accepted. And if on top of that you have a banking union in Europe, a banking system in Europe which is European, then it's much more likely that the euro will be an international currency. Now it's going backwards in that sense. And your question is very well posed. Is that your thesis mm-hmm. on the international role of the euro?
No, I didn't ask the question on it though.
Okay, just that. So it's very well posed, and it suddenly is something that has been from nowhere to kind of very high up in the radar of all policymakers and people talking about it. I have really, to my surprise, I mean, because of the Iranian thing.
And it's not just the United States. Chinese are also pursuing the internationalization of the revenue.
Yeah.
And so you are in the position where you are in danger of being squeezed, potentially, between the two.
So mm-hmm. yes, no, but that's totally true. I mean, there is a moment right now which is very strange, right, which is Europe has suddenly realized how necessary it is, how you can't count on the Trump umbrella, you are squeezed between China and the US in many ways, not just monetarily. But if we raise our eyes and we look more broadly, think of the Green Deal and other environmental policies and so on. And then it's like, okay, you now need to act, right? You're in the verge of the swimming pool, and you need to throw yourself into the pool, and you're there, and you're thinking, it's cold. Europe needs to now act. And what we are seeing, and what I fear we are seeing this year with Brexit, which means there's less money available, and means the MFF negotiation is a nightmare. Sound like a bureaucrat. The negotiation of the budget for the next 7 years is very complicated. Which is now, so just to back up just 1 second. Countries have to design a financial framework for euro over a period of 7 years. Countries are now having that conversation. There is a big hole, and you need to leave to fill up this hole, which is from the UK's contribution. And some countries have to put more, or some countries that receive have to receive less. They all have veto power on this. So thinking the world with loss aversion plus politicians who have to go back home to defend their deals, how are you going to cut either agriculture or one third of the budget is agriculture, one third of the budget is cohesion, one third of the budget is the rest. You want to do more things in defense, internationalization, you want to do more things in green, etc. But you do not have more contributions, and nobody wants to cut what they receive, the agriculture and the cohesion. It's the recipe for a very complicated negotiation this year. They met for a couple of days, they failed, and they will have to meet again. But obviously no politician wants to go back home saying, I lost 10% of our farmers' get. That's not something you want to sell. I mean, it's different, right? If it's in positive, I was hoping to get 8, but I managed to get 1.5. It's different than they were hoping to cut 25%. I managed to only get 15% cuts. It's like, they're going to fly, I think.
C-
Can I ask a very naive question?
Those are the worst.
The doom loop has two parts. One part is when the banks are too big for the state, Ireland in the height of the crisis. And the other one is when the state is too big for the banks, right? Banks have too much government paper, and when the government gets into trouble, the banks get into trouble. The first one is hard to solve unless you have Europe-wide bailout mechanisms, and of course the ESM and other mechanisms have moved in that direction. The second one arises from something that, and this is the naive part of my question, I understand why in countries in which nobody wants to buy my debt, and if I'm a government, I stick the debt into the banks. You know, it's called the Argentine model of policymaking, right? Every time Argentina's in trouble, you ring up the banks and you say, I have some debt for you guys, and if you don't want to hold my debt, you know, the tax inspector is waiting outside. Today, interest rates are negative, and government paper is not exactly hard to place. So why are we condemned to a situation in which European banks hold so much government paper?
So I have sad news for you. This Argentinian model is...
it's an export industry.
It's an export industry. So there are... The people who killed Dimitri, our proposal, are a set of civil servants who are called DMOs, debt management officers. Okay? These are not even treasury ministers or secretaries of state for economics. And you would think, why would this debt management officer, lowly general director, be able to overrule, you know, the parliament passed it, the commission passed it, all of these people passed it? Well, these guys became very, very powerful in some countries when actually debt was very difficult to place. Mm-hmm. And those guys, in those moments, they needed to do the Argentinian thing. And I've mm-hmm. seen it firsthand at banks and everything. The way that during 2011, 12, 13, 14, debt was placed was there would be a call from the Treasury to one of these big banks, mm-hmm. and they would say, I'm 150 million short in this auction. I need you to pick up 55 million, and mm-hmm. this other bank will pick up 30 and so on. And mm-hmm. the answer, for the reason Andres just gave, right. is sure.
Right.
Because, you know, the regulator is calling, the one who right. decides whether you're going to be bailed out if necessary is calling. I mean, that incestuous relationship mm-hmm. is there for a reason, which is politically convenient for both sides. Mm-hmm. Marcos Brunemeyer has a paper which he calls financial dominance, finance dominance, which basically says that the banks, the state has the ear of the banks, and the bank has the ear of the states. That the problem, the political economy of this is much more mundane, right? Why does the, I mean, let me say something very politically incorrect. Why does the ECB and the Federal Reserve and the UK in Bank of England have private briefings for bankers? Why do they have this continuous flow of information? They see, they talk, etc. They have something to say about the economy. They could just go and think, put a microphone and explain it. Well, because there's this relationship that gets established where you buy my debt, I buy yours kind of thing. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily all the time the Argentinian model, but it certainly holds the possibility that, I mean, the guy from Deutsche Bank who convinced Merkel to do the hypo real estate bailout, mm-hmm. hypo, what's it exactly? That banker had an explicit interest in hypo, both directly and indirectly. And who is Merkel going to call when the whole thing is in trouble? I mean, you wish they would call some finance professors at some faculty, but everybody will convince them that those finance professors are living in the clouds. They don't know anything about banks. No, you have to call the banker. Well, you know what the banker is going to advise you, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're all Argentines after all.
Yeah.
Even nicely behaved Northern Europeans, what a depressing thought. Yes. We have time for one more question. He or she who gets the last question gets the last word. There we go.
Hi, Orkun Seka from European Institute. So just to the last point you made about this private conversations between bankers and the government. So there is definitely scope for lots of political economy explanations that may be tied to those private conversations, but also I think there is an underexplored part of this relationship which may also lead to an information exchange between those parties. And crisis moments are usually the moments where, you know, there is a lot of panic, especially on the part of the foreign investors, which we see not only in the sovereign debt crisis, but if you look in the literature, it happens in the stock market crashes, where the foreign investors are the first to sell to the domestic investors. So information plays a big role in terms of how the securities exchange hands in the times of the crisis. So do you think information may have also played a role in terms of increasing the home bias?
Okay, so first of all, ostensibly, the reasons that people meet are information exchanges. So I would imagine at least some role it must play. And so here's the hypothesis that has been put to us. So there are two reasons that BNP would buy French debt, if the French state was in trouble. One is, which is the one you're advancing, BNP really knows the French state is not in trouble. Mm-hmm. Okay, they have good information, they've been talking to the Treasury, they know how much money is coming in, they have actually the paychecks of all the civil servants, etc. A second is the Treasury called BNP and said, look guys, I mean, nobody wants to buy our debt, you're the only one hope we have, and you got to do it now. This is the moment to be French. There's a third, which to me is the one that is more promising. And there must be lots of papers, JP and Dimitri, on this, I imagine, which is the one I've seen it kind of happening, right? Which is, yes, there are papers on this. Your survival is correlated with the survival of the state. So think of the binomial tree. In one branch, all that branch, France survives, you get your 8% on the debt you bought in very distressed moments. In the other branch, you're dead anyway. So if France is going to go, you're going to die. So this security has no risk for you because you're dead anyway. And on the other side of the tree, it gives you a big payout. So for a home bank to be highly correlated investing in their own bank, in certain ways, it's risk-free. Because you might think, look, if we're French and France goes down, we're all dead anyway, kind of thing, you know? So I might as well invest all my money in France. If things go well, I survive. If they go badly, anyway, I was going to die anyway. So I'm not increasing my risk. That third reason, to me, is the more plausible, more than the information reason, and in general, except in big moments of stress, more than the moral suasion.
Our fates are tied, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. Right. That's the second. That's the second, and I do think that there is an element of the moral suasion, they doing this because you're French kind of thing, and let's do it, France. Yes. That's also can.
But I'm sure there's a word in French for free riding, right?
Yes. somebody can say yes.
It's like somebody can say you do it. After you.
Yeah.
You know, all right, I think
thanks
we're out of time. We have learned a lot. We leave here no more optimistic about politics, but we leave optimistic about the ingenuity of the proposal. Thank you very much, everybody, and please...